Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If saving more and spending less is one of your top goals for 2023, why are you still paying insane amounts of money every month for your phone bill? Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile, you'll get their unlimited plan for 50% off. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton with phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Cut your wireless bill to 15 bucks a month at mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Hurry. Offer ends January 15th.
Today, running your small or mid-sized business is challenging to say the least. There is greater pressure to offer a flexible and safe work environment. At HP, we get that. We design our products to support the needs of both the traditional office space and your employees' hybrid environment. We create IT solutions that help run your small or mid-sized business no matter where your employees are. Whether you have 5 employees or 500, HP can help. Call our U.S.-based small business advisor team today at 1-800-608-MYHP or click below.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 21st of January, these are our main stories. President Zelensky says he'll keep pushing for Ukrainian forces to be given German tanks as his country's allies remain divided over whether to provide them. The Russian mercenary group Wagner has been designated an international criminal organization by the US and accused of committing widespread atrocities. Anti-abortion activists have been marching in Washington to demand further restrictions months after the Supreme Court overturned federal abortion rights. Also in this podcast,
vast oceans of liquid water beneath their icy surfaces. And wherever we find water in the solar system, and there's a lot of it on Earth, we think there is a chance for life.
Final testing for Europe's JUICE spacecraft, which is hoping to find life on Jupiter's icy moons. For Ukraine, there was a lot riding on a meeting of Western allies in Germany on Friday. Representatives of more than 50 countries gathered at a US airbase to discuss the coordination of stronger military support for President Zelensky. There have been pledges of missiles, but no movement on the one big ask from Kyiv, a delivery of German-made Leopard 2 tanks, both from the Germans themselves and from other countries which need Berlin's permission to release them. Speaking to reporters, Germany's Defence Minister Boris Pistorius was asked why Berlin was hesitating over allowing the transfer.
We are not really hesitating. We are just very carefully in balance and all the pros and cons. We are not talking just about delivering anything to anybody. This is a new kind of measure we would choose, and so we have to be carefully, because we have a duty to look carefully and intensively on what might be the consequences for anybody in that conflict.
Despite the failure to get an agreement on the Leopard tanks, in his nightly address, President Zelensky still remained positive.
Today's meeting in Ramstein will strengthen our resilience. Our partners are principled in their approach. They will support Ukraine as long as necessary for our victory. Yes, we will still have to fight for the supply of modern tanks, but every day we make it more obvious that there is no alternative to the fact that the decision on tanks must be taken.
With more, here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
It's not been a good day for Ukraine because they were really holding out that the veto was going to be lifted and these desperately needed Leopard 2 tanks, which there's more than 2,000 of them sitting in warehouses across 14 countries in Europe. They could be provided relatively easily to Ukraine. They are easy to maintain. It would take very little time to train Ukrainian crews on them. But there are some roadblocks on the way to this. So this will be very disappointing to Ukraine, notwithstanding the fact that there was consensus at Ramstein today to provide a lot of military equipment to them, things like armored vehicles, air defense, ammunition, all of which Ukraine welcomes. But they haven't now got the tools. Not only are they not going to be able to mount their own effective spring offensive to push the Russians out of areas that they've conquered, but they also might struggle to repel a new advance by Russia in the coming weeks. Because remember that all of this time, throughout winter, when the fighting is relatively static, Russia is training up a whole new cadre of well over 100,000 troops. Now, they're not going to be particularly well-trained or well-equipped or well-motivated, but there is a strength in numbers. And Ukraine worries that without main battle tanks, the modern Leopard 2, it simply won't be able to repel wave after wave of Russian infantry advances backed by all their heavy artillery.
Frank Gardner. I asked our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, in Moscow how this lack of agreement will be seen by the Kremlin.
Oh, that phrase, Alex, lack of agreement, that is music to Vladimir Putin's ears. He loves that. Whenever there's division or inability to agree amongst Western allies. So I think that will go down well here. The Russians will be pleased that so far there is no agreement to send American or German battle tanks to Ukraine. Interestingly, in this morning's edition of the Russian government newspaper, there was a warning to Germany and to the German Chancellor. The paper said that no one knows better than the German Chancellor what happened the last time that Germany sent armour towards the Russian borders, meaning World War II. So a very strong message. And the Russians, as I say, will be pleased, I think, that no German tanks for the moment will be sent to Ukraine. Of course, there are other tanks that are being supplied to Ukraine. For example, the British Challenger 2 tanks are being sent there. But earlier today, the Kremlin was quite dismissive about such supplies. President Putin's spokesman said that the importance of such deliveries shouldn't be exaggerated, that they wouldn't change the situation on the ground, and that they wouldn't stop Russia achieving its goals.
How do the German tanks compare with the hardware that Russia has?
I think there is a concern in Russia that the delivery of modern European tanks, like the Challengers from Britain, like the Leopards from Germany or Abrams from America, could make a difference. The message from Ramstein coming out was that everybody is supporting Ukraine and everybody wants to help Ukraine. But clearly, some countries are unsure, a little bit nervous about sending certain armour. And, you know, the Russians will be pleased about that. Moscow has been sending out a message that really anyone in the West who wants to defeat Russia on the battleground in Ukraine is playing with fire. Only this week, Dmitry Medvedev, the former Russian president, wrote that if a nuclear country like Russia is defeated in a conventional war, then that could be the beginning of a nuclear war.
And I'm guessing the sense will be in Moscow that those warnings are being heard and worried about in Western capitals.
Yeah, I think so. And because of that, I think you can expect more of the same, you know, more such warnings. Obviously, discussions, I think, will continue in the West about arms supplies. And whenever these discussions take place, I think you can expect similar warnings coming out of Moscow. You know, the Russians will do all they can to prevent this happening. Because although the official message from Russia, from the Kremlin, is everything is going according to plan, we are going to win this, clearly everything is not going according to plan for them. You know, this war, which the Kremlin still calls a special military operation, and which was supposed to be over in days, weeks maximum, has been going on for nearly a year. And there is no sign of an imminent Russian victory.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. The United States, meanwhile, has said it's designating the Russian mercenary group Wagner as an international criminal organization. The White House said Wagner was committing atrocities and human rights abuses in Ukraine and elsewhere. Here's our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue.
This designation will, according to officials, put the squeeze on Wagner's ability to do business around the world. The US is also reporting North Korea to the UN Security Council for alleged sanctions violations for supplying arms and munitions to the mercenary group back in November. Washington believes there are growing tensions between the leadership of the group under Yevgeny Prigozhin and Russian military leaders, something officials are keen to highlight and amplify.
Gary O'Donoghue. The British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has been fined by the police for failing to wear a seatbelt in a car. He could be fined up to £100. That's around $120. The details from our political correspondent David Wallace Lockhart.
Rishi Sunak was going across the north of England because he was announcing levelling up funding. So essentially government funding that was going to specific projects in different parts of the UK. And as part of him trying to get the government's message out about this, he recorded a video he posted on Instagram. The video featured him in the back of the car talking about why he was visiting Lancashire. Now, in the video, he didn't have his seatbelt on. Many people picked up on this, and it was put to the Prime Minister's official spokesman, who said that he fully accepted it was a mistake and apologised, and they called it a brief error of judgment, explaining that he only took off his seatbelt to film the video. But we did hear the Lancashire Police were looking into it, and this evening they announced that they had decided it was worthy of a fixed penalty notice, a fine for not wearing the seatbelt. That's something Rishi Sunak could have decided to challenge, but has said that he accepts and will be paying the fine. We've heard that from Number 10. This is the second fine that Rishi Sunak has had in the past year, because of course when he was Chancellor he did get a fine as part of, if you remember, Partygate, those gatherings that took place in Downing Street during COVID, when there was meant to be restrictions in place around gatherings. He was fined over one of those meetings he attended that had some party food around for Boris Johnson's birthday. So the second fine that Rishi Sunak will have to pay for a fixed penalty notice within 12 months.
David Wallace Lockhart. Scientists are putting the finishing touches to a spacecraft that's about to embark on one of the European Space Agency's most ambitious missions. It will head to the outer solar system to study some of Jupiter's most mysterious moons, the icy Callisto, Europa and Ganymede. There are hints that beneath their surface are oceans of water, and scientists think it's the best place in the solar system to hunt for life. I spoke to our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
It's really one of the grand adventures of European space exploration. Europe has never sent a big spacecraft like this into the outer reaches of the solar system. It's the first one to do it, first one to go into orbit around an object out there. Europe has gone along with NASA in the past to do things at Saturn and Titan, its big moon. But at Jupiter, this is going to be completely novel. And it's going to study the Galileo moons, as we call them. So Galileo discovered in 1610 that there were these satellites going around Jupiter. And he used them as a bit of a clock to study that system. And we've been very interested in them ever since. Not least, Alex, because three of them have, we now understand, vast oceans of liquid water beneath their icy surfaces. And wherever we find water, there is a chance for life. So who knows what might be out there?
Life? It really could happen?
Well, Jupiter is so big, you know, that it squeezes and squashes the moons. Tides ripple through their surfaces, their icy surfaces, and that provides the energy to keep this water liquid. So that's one ingredient, obviously. You need liquid water, you need some energy. Well, the gravitational forces of Jupiter provide that. Have you got the right chemistry, though? It's got 10 scientific instruments, so it'll fly through the sort of plumes that come off sometimes of these bodies. We know that Europa, which is one of these bodies, it throws water ice out into space. They'll fly through that. They'll use radar to look beneath the surface. They'll map its surface. They'll use a magnetometer instrument to study the magnetic and electrical fields around these bodies. And that will tell you an awful lot about the oceans that live beneath the surface, you know, just how salty they might be or just how deep they might be. Because we think some of them may be tens of kilometres deep. Now, the deepest point on Earth's oceans is found in the Pacific. You know, it's about 10K down, the Mariana Trench in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Imagine an ocean that's 100 kilometres deep. Well, we think we might have one of those on the moons as well. So, yeah, really interesting.
Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos. Still to come.
I'm really pleased it's changing. For my, you know, gay friends, I'm really pleased. And I wasn't expecting to get emotional.
Has the Anglican Church overcome the row about gay marriage? Anti-abortion campaigners from across the United States have been rallying in Washington for the 50th annual March for Life. It's the first such gathering since the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling was overturned, which protected the right to an abortion. Kristen Hawkins is from the campaign group Students for Life of America.
Here at Capitol Hill, we're passing legislation to restrict abortion, protect women from a predatory industry when abortions happen in that first trimester.
Because it's worth mentioning that there are about 12 to 13 states that have a near ban on abortion, but there are some states where it's not actually gone through yet, and there are some states which have upheld abortion rights. They've enshrined it in the Constitution. So it's not, from your point of view, it's not fair to say that it's completely over, right?
Reversing Roe was always step one, phase one of this movement. We will not be complete until abortion is made unthinkable and unavailable throughout all United States.
Asking the questions was our correspondent, Nomia Iqbal.
As you heard there from Kristen Hawkins, not all states have been able to ban abortion in the way they want. Right now, I'm just walking alongside the marchers. They're heading towards Congress. Usually they go towards the Supreme Court, but of course the Supreme Court has given them what they want. And now going to the Capitol is more of a sort of symbolic moment. It shows how the fight has gone from a legal one to a legislative one. But what's really interesting is that there are divisions within the anti-abortion movement on what comes next. So some of them want more stringent measures, like banning abortion pills, which is how most abortions happen in this country, medicated abortion. Then there are others that want a ban on contraception. And then there are other groups who want more public spending to help ease the social and economic issues that often factor into why women have an abortion. Because one of the criticisms that they often face by the pro-choice movement is that they don't care about the child once it's been born. They only seem to care about the child when it's in the womb. So they've all got different views on what the next objective should be.
How strong is the pro-choice lobby now?
It's actually empowered, I'd say, because during the midterm elections, lots of states had abortion rights directly on the ballot, and all those states upheld the right to an abortion. That includes states like Kentucky, which is a very conservative state. I was in Kansas just before the midterm elections, which had abortion rights directly on the ballot, and they upheld the right. They enshrined into the Constitution. So the pro-choice movement has taken that as a sign that not all Americans are on the same page when it comes to being happy about Roe v. Wade being overturned.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. Russia's war against Ukraine is hitting Africans particularly hard by exacerbating food insecurity and slowing economic growth across the continent. That's according to the US Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, who has been in Senegal at the start of a 10-day three-nation tour of Africa.
The U.S. is committed to working with Africa to realize the promise of a better economic future. We know that a stronger African economy is good for the world and good for America, and the work you're doing here is really incredible. An overriding focus of my trip to Africa is the enormous economic potential the continent has, thanks to its demographic trends and the impressive dynamism of its growing cohort of young and diverse entrepreneurs.
Ms. Yellen also said the US was working with African leaders to mitigate the damage caused by, as she put it, Russia's illegal and unprovoked war in Ukraine, which, along with COVID-19, has put millions of Africans into poverty and hunger. Her trip is seen as an effort by the Biden administration to offer African governments and businesses an alternative source of investment to that of China. Our Africa business reporter, Vimani Mkhizi, told us there's a significant amount that Africa stands to gain from the visit.
Clearly, the U.S. is reshaping its economic and political agenda towards Africa. So the African continent as large can expect more economic engagement from the US and particularly more investment, and which is encouraging for many African countries who in the past have been quite ignored by previous administrations of the United States government, particularly the Trump administration. So clearly, President Joe Biden's administration is seeking to relaunch its agenda towards Africa and is clearly aiming to invest much more in African economies.
And how easy a task will that be, reconnecting this relationship between the continent and the US, given how far China, Russia, India, some would argue Turkey, have come since America kind of like backed off?
I mean, it's not going to be an easy task. Like you said, all of those countries have made significant inroads in Africa, particularly China. China is Africa's biggest creditor. Many infrastructure build programs around the continent have been financed by China, and China's involvement in Africa is entrenched. We've seen the Chinese foreign minister, who was recently in Ethiopia, just embark on a foreign trip. And the Chinese foreign minister embarks on a foreign trip to Africa every year for the past 33 years. And that's how much the United States needs to do in order to catch up. But I think it's not insurmountable. They can catch up if they provide significant investment. We've seen the Africa Leadership Summit in Washington in December, where $55 billion of investment pledges were made. And so the United States needs to step up even further if it wants to somehow catch up with China in the future.
And why is this relationship so important to the U.S.?
It's very important because, as Janet Yellen said earlier, that the demographic trends are moving in a very positive step. I think in 2050, one in four people in the world will be African. So the demographic dividend is very hard to ignore for the United States. And also finance green technology. Most of those minerals can be found here in Africa. So significant inroads need to be made within this particular continent if we want to make inroads in terms of addressing climate change and providing a cleaner energy for the world going forward.
Vamani Mkhize talking to Peter Akoche. The Archbishop of Canterbury, who is the spiritual leader of millions of Anglicans around the world, has said that he won't personally use proposed new prayers to bless same-sex couples. Justin Welby said he welcomed the change, but had a responsibility to act as a figure of unity for the global Anglican Church, most of which is still very conservative on sexuality. The Church of England has issued a formal apology for what it said were the shameful times it had rejected or excluded LGBTQI+ people. Our religious affairs reporter Harry Farley has more details.
It's a sign of just how divided both the Church of England and the Global Anglican Communion is on sexuality that Justin Welby felt the need to impose what he described as a self-denying ordinance and not bless gay couples himself.
Because of my pastoral care and responsibility in being a focus of unity for the whole communion, I will, while being extremely joyfully celebratory of these new resources, I will not personally use them in order not to compromise that pastoral care.
The Archbishop of York said he would offer the prayers to gay couples. In a sometimes passionate news conference, Stephen Cottrell said the proposals were the furthest the church could go without a change in teaching.
I'm really pleased it's changing. For my, you know, gay friends, I'm really pleased. And no, it's not enough for some, and I'm really sorry it's not enough. And I wasn't expecting to get emotional. But I am. Because I think it puts the Church of England in a better place.
The archbishops apologised for the way the church had rejected or excluded LGBT people. But the compromise of offering prayers of blessing but not weddings for gay couples risks pleasing neither side in this debate.
Harry Farley. New research suggests that people in Ecuador feel less safe than in any other Latin American country after a surge in gang-related violence over the last few years. Our America's editor Leonardo Rocha reports.
The poll carried out by Gallup showed that two-thirds of Ecuadorians didn't feel safe walking alone at night. That figure is the highest in Latin America, Until 5 years ago, Ecuador had been one of the safest countries in the region, despite bordering the world's biggest cocaine producers, Colombia and Peru. The surge in violence is attributed to the increasing presence of rival drug cartels from Mexico in Ecuador, which hired local gangs to work for them. In the area most affected by the violence, in western Ecuador, the perception of public safety is comparable to what Afghanistan experienced during the Taliban takeover.
Leonardo Rocha. Four legs bad, two legs good, wrote George Orwell in his fable Animal Farm. And it appears that baboons are in agreement. While they generally walk around on 4 feet, scientists say they can easily be prompted to walk around on two. The research, published in the Journal of Experimental Biology, suggests that walking upright is not nearly as hard as had been thought. Terry Egan reports.
The researchers looked at 10 baboons of varying ages, both male and female. Using random sounds, music, food and mirrors, they coaxed them into walking upright so they could film their movements, then analysed the video, breaking it down into segments, including for head, body, arms and legs. An examination of the individual frames enabled the researchers to see how the entire body moved as each baboon, despite being four-footed, manoeuvred into an upright posture in less than a second. As the researchers put it, the primates crouched their hind limbs, then sprinted them forward under the torso, while taking two or three steps, lifting the body upright as they stood to walk without missing a beat. What's key is how much energy was being used, and here the scientists calculated that as the animals reared up, little energy or effort was required. A few decades ago, the scientists say, it was thought that humans were the only bipeds, and walking was seen as something unique. This study suggests that while the ability to walk upright on two legs, known as bipedalism, is one of humanity's defining physical characteristics, it's not as challenging a feat as previously thought. We've just been better at exploiting it.
Terry Egan, who has been walking around on two legs very well for some years now. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Neil Sackley, and the producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Small and medium businesses keep the American dream alive. The people at HP get this. In fact, we started our business in a garage over 80 years ago. That's why HP has a dedicated team of U.S.-based small and medium business advisors and customer service agents exclusively to solve your technology needs. Call us today at 1-800-608-MYHP or click below to learn more.